anytime that there's channel saturation, that channel will become less effective over time. And it's because people are saturating that channel and not saturating other channels, which then means the other channels that you haven't been saturating then become interesting places.
I'm Margaret Kelsey.
And I'm Devin Bramhall.
And this is Don't Say Content,
a show created in partnership with Share Your Genius. We wanted to talk to CMOs and find out what was going on. And my approach to finding who to talk to was more around talking to folks I don't hear from all the time out in the world. It doesn't mean they don't have presences and, you know, following, but I really was interested in perspectives from people I don't talk to every day. And so I reached out to three people I didn't know and should know. I spoke to Erica Varanguli. She was head of SEO branding at Semrush. And then I talked to Natalie Marcatulio, who's the head of growth at Novatic. And I talked to Dylan Figlio, who runs an agency. I'd never heard of him before, but it's an agency called Decent Startup. And they work primarily with e-commerce companies on like setting up their like ops, sort of like fractional ops, marketing, all that stuff. Erica's really deep in SEO, similar to a CMO, overseeing a lot. And then Dylan's coming at it from an agency perspective, but not B2B. Like I did some reading, there's a McKinsey report I looked into, and kind of just talking generally with, you know, the marketers that we already talked to, companies. Like I just started working with a new client who does growth marketing for companies. So hearing about it from the sort of paid media and SEO and RevOps standpoint. So there were no big reveals. So if you want to just stop listening now, you can, because you haven't. No, I'm kidding.
No, I think that like if there's no big reveals, it's then the messages, we're all in it together. This is what's happening. And I think that's exactly what, and let me make sure I had the right person that said this. Oh, it was Natalie. She was talking about the fact of, especially as like leads go down, it's easy to be like, oh my God, our leads are going down or our leads aren't growing. And like, oh, that's big and scary. And she was talking about talking with other CEOs and CMOs and realizing it's a market level problem. And so I think that there is some insight into the fact of like, yes, maybe there's no big reveals, but it's also, you're not crazy. Like this is happening to everyone right now.
Yeah. And maybe it's also a fact that like as consultants, we have better access to pattern recognition because we're talking across so many clients. And so it might just be that we have that broad level overview that someone working in the industry, like directly in a business in the industry, maybe doesn't. Because I feel like the same is true on the agency side. Like when I talk to these agency CEOs, they think they're uniquely doing something wrong all of a sudden, that their product is no longer useful. And I think the mistake a lot of them are making is pivoting. They're considering pivoting the company or launching a new product. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on a second. And if you really dug into this quarter, it wasn't all bad. January sucked for everybody. February, March started to look better. No one fucking knows about the rest of the year. And that's basically everyone in the whole world. But to your point about the leads drying up, there's also changes in marketing that are net good, but can look bad. So one example is a company who lost a lot of traffic in the recent Google updates. But actually, this agency I'm working for, when they broke the numbers down, they're like, your leads are actually higher and we predict they're going to grow this year if you don't do anything at all. And your revenue is growing too. So like the two bottom line metrics that they really want to hit, that traffic they see, because it used to be this really sort of a correlation between traffic and leads, right? You could say, okay, if we grow traffic by this much based on our conversion rate, right? But that's not, with these updates, it was like basically getting rid of a lot of irrelevant traffic. And so it's actually net positive. But if you're not looking at the data appropriately, you're like, oh no, traffic is down. It's like, okay, bye, bitch. Like we are done with you anyway.
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting thing that I think Erica was talking about, is this idea of like, if everyone's doing a similar approach and everyone's hopping on the same bandwagon and have been over the last few years, I think it is hard to parse that out of like, oh, we're measuring all these metrics because we've always measured these metrics because there's always been a correlation. But if something changes and there's not a correlation anymore, if everyone's kind of doing the same playbook, it's really challenging to break them out of that or to do that education of it actually doesn't matter if traffic goes down, if leads and revenue are trending in the right direction. And maybe we've always said that there's a correlation here, but something's changing right now.
Yeah. And that was something in the McKinsey report that was interesting because they had gone out and interviewed a bunch of Fortune 500, Fortune 250 CEOs and CMOs because they're trying to answer the same question we've been asking, which is what's up with this relationship? What's broken? And CMOs and CEOs, which again is like the topic that you and I are low-key obsessed with. And one of the things they pointed to was like marketing, we're in the post-Mad Men area of time of marketing in which marketing was static for a really long time. Like the tactics for a long time were kind of the same, right? And they didn't enter technology and they've been changing constantly ever since. And so the only constant going forward is a constantly changing marketing landscape, which means that playbooks are quite literally dead. This isn't just like me railing against playbook, but I'm like, they are not the way to go anymore. There isn't an out-of-the-box solution. And thank goodness, because it's a lot easier now to get the data you need to make creative decisions, conduct experiments, and find your unique opportunity.
Yeah. And that was, again, all of Erica's conversation was, I think her concern is that with the glut of data that we've been able to expect over the last few years, that folks sometimes will slow down because they're trying to make data-informed decisions or data-driven decisions. And she had a really interesting point of like, we can't do everything based on data, right? And marketing, especially as an organization, should not have to make every single decision based on data. If anything, that will slow you down because it's only historically looking. It's not future looking. And so I think there's an interesting thing here about, yes, data isn't inherently bad. It's not, don't make any decisions based on data. But there's a really interesting executive conversation to be had around what do we need to have and how much data do we need to have. And she even went into this idea of like, I think she didn't say the same thing that we said, but it was around culture of experimentation, of small bets, collecting insights, and then making a bigger creative bet on top of that, because you have some data points that lead you in the right direction, like minimum viable data, right? I think that's a more approachable solution for 2024 and beyond than like needing every decision that a marketing team makes to be based on statistically significant data, which is just not possible.
Yeah. And this actually, this came up in my conversation with Dylan and partially in the report. It's kind of two concepts. One is marketing teams are still not structured with the appropriate resources. So the way he described it was like a creative technology flywheel where right now, marketing has to justify getting things like developer resources, design resources. And so when they can't get that, and headcount's low right now, budgets are low, their creative is getting stale, which means that, you know, they may hire an advertising agency to help them and do sort of the paid media stuff, but they're using old creative. And so it's not necessarily as effective. Nor is it specific enough. You need to be testing different value props and messaging. And without that, it's like, of course, your performance has plateaued, right? You can't just boil it all up to some macro trend of saturation, cookie restrictions, and blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, also, you don't have exactly what you need. And that goes back to what the McKinsey report was saying about, which we've talked about a lot, the challenges of marketing being able to tie the value of activities back to things that the CFO and the CEO understand. And so I want to just like read an excerpt from this because it was so illustrative. It says there's a disconnect between data analytics and business impact. And there's a couple things they point to. CEO has less marketing pedigree. They said only 10% of the Fortune 250 CEOs have marketing experience.
What was the percentage?
10%.
Oh, yeah. I'm surprised it's that high.
I know.
Less than 10%, meaning 0.1%.
Then you add to that the technology that is both giving us additional channels in which to market in and measure them. But because a customer has such a bigger island of experiences, it's not just a few tactics that you're trying to try together. It's many, some of which are invisible. It's harder to kind of like tell that story and connect all the dots, which means that it isn't just something that communicating impact isn't just on the CMO. The CEO and CFO need to understand those measurement systems too, that they know, hey, when I cut budget, what does that mean? When I invest in marketing, what does that mean? And how can I tie those activities to outcomes? And I think that was from the report. I thought those two things, what Dylan was talking about with the flywheel and the CEO, CMO, like this really is bigger than a CMO reporting better or low-level marketers reporting better. Because the other thing was, there was some statistic in there about the number of CMOs that are actually have a seat at the C-suite. It was crazy low. So they're basically, even at these huge corporations, CMOs are being delivered objectives that they're expected to execute on, but they should be the one working with the C-suite to craft those objectives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I look back at my notes the entire time. Erica was saying it's marketing's job to challenge the perception of the people that they're talking to. And that includes executive leadership. And I literally wrote it down as a quote because I was like, such an important mindset shift of I am not like being bad. I'm not being difficult. This isn't a battle. It is my job as a marketer to change people's perceptions about things, about the product I'm marketing, about the services I'm marketing, or to my executive leadership about the work that I'm doing. And that is a piece of my work. And I loved hearing that come out of her mouth because I was like, yes, it is about changing perceptions, right? Changing perceptions and influencing behavior, I think. But specifically, changing perceptions is the thing you have to do before you can influence behavior. And I loved hearing that come out of her mouth.
Yeah. And we really saw that firsthand. Or I've seen that firsthand over years through animals and the agencies I work with now where, you know, they get these, even working with the CMO, the CMO is in many cases battling. They're like, I know this one thing we need from you isn't important. And that I get you are trying to lead us to water. You're trying to get us to focus on the right thing. And if they don't have that credibility among the C-suite in their position, in a position of power, the power that their title should give them already, it's like, it's kind of not their fault. So then it gets pushed down to the team and the team's like, I don't get why we're doing this, you know? And so you can start to see the multiple levels of discontent and why there's still a lot of animosity between varying levels of folks on the marketing team. I think in a lot of cases, it's starting from the top. Not always. Some managers just suck too. Yeah. So.
And to dive really deep down, I was talking to a content writer, content marketer earlier today. And I was telling her, I'm like, I can tell whether or not a marketing team is having fun based on their public facing copy and creative that they create. I can tell whether that marketing team is happy or not or having fun or not. And so what you're also thinking, like what you're also alluding to is that if CMOs don't have a seat at the table and are not making these choices and it's delivered to them and then it's delivered down in the team to execute. And to your point, there's like, should we even be doing this? Why are we doing this? What are we doing? It creates a culture and an environment where they're going to not be playful because they don't think that they have the room to play and to be creative. And that shows up in your copy and in your creatives and in your marketing in a way that then makes your customers not care, right? And so I think the biggest indicator of getting customers or prospects to care is having a marketing team that cares, and they have to feel empowered in the work that they do, right? It's not just like checking a box. It's not like just turning a dial. It's the passion and the energy flows through the marketing team to your target audience, and it's either contagious or it isn't.
Yeah. And also to that point, do they have energy as one? But what about those who have the energy, but don't have the resources? So now their energy is just, it can't, disseminate, right? They can't get it out there. And so it's just pent up, which ends up
versus completely zaps your energy too, right? Like, even if you're a good creative person that cares, not having enough resources and feeling like your hair is always on fire means that you're not going to have the time to be playful or creative.
Obviously, a lot of marketers feel that way right now because of headcount that got slashed. Now, again, some of that headcount made sense. Marketing teams got over-segmented and bloated, and that wasn't working either. But the response, like, that's just a pendulum swinging from one extreme to the other. What you want is the pendulum swinging in like a little bit in the middle, right? And so it's never going to be perfectly in balance.
It's never full executive thrash. It's just a nice swing on a swing.
I wish. So there was another thing that Dylan brought up that I thought was like something that I probably encounter more, because a lot of agencies' blocker to growth is infrastructure because they're a service-based business. But he called this out for SaaS companies too. And he's talking about this whole idea of headcount. He's like, all right, I feel bad for CMOs and I feel bad for marketing managers right now, right? Because they have no headcount budget, but they have $250,000 to spend unpaid. And it's like, okay, that's fine. But if those paid campaigns on Facebook need different creative in order to learn if they're even, it's not just about having the money to put the ad out. It's like you need the creative for the ad. And so it's like, if you're sending them to an old landing page or the messaging has already been tested before, you know, it's like that doesn't make any sense either. And it's also short-sighted. So he's talking about like the decision is being made to pass the dollars to the advertiser to hit 1 million per month rather than solidifying the team that can get you to 50 million or 10 or 50 million in a month. You know what I mean? And so it's like, again, I feel like that panic reaction to change that is so common among these executives, who I'm pretty sure his job it is to be more balanced. And it's just like, it's compromising long-term. It's like those companies that invest in marketing when shit's going south and like you look at 3 years down the line and they're crushing everybody else.
Yeah, because I think you have to be a little contrarian. If everyone is restricting investing in marketing, that might be the time to invest in marketing and take over. But to your point, Natalie brought that up too, is like the biggest challenge is that nobody has time right now. There's this bandwidth constraint. And even if somebody knows that it's a good idea and that it would produce ROI, there's literally like this, well, I can't have somebody on my team do something else, or like I can't take that on, or I'm, you know, juggling all these other things. And so I feel like it used to be all you had to do, even as a marketer selling something, is just like make a good case that it was a good idea and would produce ROI. And it sounds like right now you have to go beyond that in some sort of way and find the thing that's actually going to convince somebody, because it's not enough to just be like, hey, buy this product or adopt this thing. It's a good idea and you're going to have ROI. Like there's something beyond that now of like, and here's how to actually find the resources to implement it or do it, or I don't know.
I mean, no wonder why MarTech companies are having a very bad time, because there's no one on the team. They might need that tool, but there's no one on the team to set it up. Yeah. Or even use it. And so, you know, you've got this like sort of built-in inefficiency, and you start to see how it's trickling into all these different like segments of the industry pretty easily, especially on the marketing side. Dylan had an interesting perspective. I asked him, you know, it's sort of your like Hail Mary question, like, what are you surprised by? Just to try to dig something out that you didn't know. And he said that he's been surprised by the amount of companies still chasing top line dollars, high fast growth with the hope of IPO. And he's like, not only it's difficult to get money right now, and we haven't exactly had a recent positive outcome from IPOs, you know, it's like it hasn't been a rosy story. And he said, I'm surprised by how many businesses where we have to say to them, stop looking at gross revenue. I'm not going to have my advertisers look at gross revenue. It's not a reality of the way that the business is running. We need to look at net revenue, and we need to look at revenue, at return on investment based on net revenue dollars. So looking at percentage they're spending on marketing as a percentage of net revenue, not gross. And his whole point, which this goes back to my whole rant about small businesses, like tech companies are just small businesses. So why are we complicating it? Is he's like, at the end of the day, if you're a bodega, you still need to bring in more money than you spend. The startup model was intended to be different. It's like you can grow a company, be unprofitable, but how well has that worked? You know, if you look at the percentage of companies that fail versus succeed. And so he's saying is like, part of it is just the very structure of your company from the get-go. It's like going back to first principles.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting because there's been such a flip-flop of advice on that over the last couple of years, but it is a conscious choice that you have to make as you're building a company over, am I going to go this super high growth, not worried about profitability, and be at risk of not being able to raise additional rounds of funding versus do I raise just enough or nothing at all and bootstrap and, you know, continue to grow profitably. And I think that the fear is that it's easier to create a software startup than ever before. So there's more popping up all of the time. And I do think that there's like that threat of market urgency over like win or lose kind of thing. But it's so funny. And I know we've talked about this before, but even the clients that I'm advising have completely flipped over the last year and a half or so that I've been advising from mostly VC back to mostly bootstrapped and profitable. That's a very small percentage. It's a very small like data point, but it is interesting that I don't know if it's survivorship bias or whatever it is, but there are lots of companies these days because it's easier to start a software startup than ever before that are taking the bootstrapped profitability route. And those might be the ones that actually stick around and then eventually have IPOs.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, what changed the business strategy was VC investment. That's what created that timeline where it's like, we have to grow really fast because we have commitments to our investors. But if you look back at like when you used to start a company, investing in companies isn't new. It sometimes looked different, like getting loans, for example. And you pay that loan off over time and your company slowly grows. If you look at that kind of in the same way, the only difference between their investors is this like timeline that accommodated before lack of profitability, figuring it would just pan out in the end. You know, they'd figure it out along the way. And
well, the idea is that you grab enough of the market share that then you have ownership over the entire market and can change pricing and kind of monopolize.
A friend of mine was just talking about this really cool company that he is advising, and they make sensors for data centers. And he is very intelligent, so could speak in great detail about that. And I was like, wow, this is huge. Like, there's a lot of potential in this area. There's already three people. There's already three companies. And I was like, this sounds new to me. Like, I can see the case more now for that slower growth because I don't know, like, what market is there left to like capture and lead the way on? And especially to your point that if you can create a software business that easily, then even if you are first to market, it might be the second guy that overtakes you. So like, what is that advantage really?
I have no personal history with that. I should speak carefully because I don't know if there's the actual statistic about it. But there's definitely plenty enough stories of it not being the first person to market, but the person in subsequent that can kind of watch the person, the first to market, kind of grow and mess up and then take their own direction and take off really quickly. And so, yeah, it's not even about being first to market. And I love that because I think that's a big blocker for people who have creative new ideas. And to your point, even agencies, like how many agencies there are in the world that serve the exact same thing, right? But agencies are less scalable inherently than software.
I mean, perfect example. I had a company, an agency, ask me recently, should we get into content? I was like, no, don't. I said, the margins aren't nearly as good as the type of stuff that you're serving as a marketing product. And, you know, I think if you look at the most recent Google update, whoever the guy is on Twitter, the Google guy on Twitter who always like comes out and like talks to the whole Twitter community about it in a very long thread. And this time he was like, please, for the love of God, I'm begging you, stop creating content for Google and create it for your customer instead. What was bizarre was watching these SEOs come in and ask questions that blatantly ignored what he said. They're like, well, so what if we do, you know, what if we, and then he's like, no, focus it on your customer. And he even called out long form content. He said, not all customers need long form content. So if you're creating content because you think we like it and your customers don't, You are not going to see results from that.
Okay, let me pull up an anonymous text conversation because I was having, I won't tell you who this is because I don't want there to be any indication of what company it was or whatever. But I just want to read this. This was last night and it's just so funny because it was so perfect. She actually mentioned our Audacity episode and she goes, I have zero energy to continue to educate people on why 5 blog posts isn't a campaign strategy. And I was like laughing and told her a story. And then she goes, why is the default in 2024 a blog post? 4 question marks. She goes, today we had a campaign kickoff meeting that was literally 5 blog posts and a bunch of ebooks. And I asked if anyone thought our target audience, executives, read blog posts. The answer was no.
I want to buy her drinks and give her a hug.
Does anyone think that our target audience, executives, read blog posts? And the answer was no. And it's like, so our entire campaign strategy is based on asset creation for an asset that our target audience will not consume.
And everybody's fine.
Yeah. Everyone's like, well, we did the checklist. I read it one time that that's the campaign checklist. So I did it. And now I should get leads because, you know, because leads.
That is because leads.
Because leads. Leads will come. You know, they'll just come. I built a blog post. It's great.
I love that. Like, it's so, I don't know about you, but I feel like that's a lot of what I do when I'm working with CEOs, whether it's agency or otherwise, is just helping to undo some beliefs that have been ingrained in them.
Which going back, not to say it again, but going back to Erica's quote, marketing's job is to challenge the perception of the people that they're talking to.
But they're not in a position, but they don't have, like, not across the board, but apparently some McKinsey did a study and it must represent some people. They don't have the power in all of these instances, in which case, you know, and we see it more at startups because it's always been visible. Like, to find a startup founder who listens to their CMO is hard to find.
And you know what the interesting thing is, like, I don't even know how many of the founding members of a startup, there might be a founding engineer, you know, like not quite a co-founder, but like the first engineer that's a whatever. I've never even heard of a founding marketer. Like, you hear it like founding designer, founding engineer, founding whatever, like just outside of the actual co-founding team. I've never once heard of like founding marketer.
I'm going to say something that's probably going to get me canceled. But it's interesting to anecdotally observe the volume of male founders who are leading companies and are, when it comes to marketing, even when they admit they don't know anything about it, they act like they do and try to control it. And, you know, and I was just like, oh, that's kind of the same thing I see, you know, when we were talking about sort of misogyny in the workplace in general. I'm like, oh, a man pretending he knows more about something than someone else, even though he knows nothing. I was like, gee, I wonder how that happened.
Yeah.
If we're going to be a culture that's like, it's all about data, marketers, you got to look at data. I'm like, okay, let's look at it then. And let's ask a different question, which is like, I'm sorry to say, but there's way more male founders than women. And there's a huge breakdown in the relationship between founders and CEOs and their marketers. And it's in part because they try to exert too much influence over the marketing strategy and they don't listen to the smart people they hired to run it. And I'm like, you can't, you know what I mean? It's like, you can't not see that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Moving on. I don't want to make Margaret too uncomfortable.
I'm trying to think of a way that I could like add to the conversation productively because I completely agree with you.
Yeah. Oh, actually, there was something. There were 2 things that surprised me. So one was, and I've seen this myself, so once it was pointed out, this came out through talking to all 3 of them, and it became a theme. And then I've noticed it, I've since noticed it elsewhere, which is because there's uncertainty about search right now and generative AI and what's going to work anymore. And I've seen more companies, it sounds like there are more companies who are going back to what I would call old school tactics for growth. They're like, give me a social media plan, organic branded social media plan. And there's a part of me that loves that. Like, hey, we're going back to, you know, and maybe we can do something interesting there. But it's been remarkable. Again, or like top of funnel traffic's another one. And I'm just like, going back to this other example from earlier where it was like traffic was down, but with their existing content alone, if they did nothing, their leads and revenue would still grow this year. It's like, it's a very fear-based decision. It's like, why are you trying to create an entire new channel when in your case, search actually is working for you and you just can do more of it? And if you forego this traffic measurement, seeing again, this sort of knee-jerk reaction of, oh no, it seemed like search is dead, you know, like the search is dead bullshit. So now they're like, well, it's organic social. I'm like, no.
Well, it's funny that the people, when they start seeing the playbooks not working, it's funny that somebody is like, oh, I just need to flip to page 20 of the playbook and focus my effort there rather than maybe this playbook is garbage, right? It's like, oh, just let's see everything that we missed in this playbook and let's go deeper into it versus toss it in the trash and figure it out. And I loved Natalie was saying that one of the things that was working for her recently or for them was in-person events, in-person conferences in person. And I know I was shouting out that dinner that I went to in Boston the other night on one of the previous episodes, but I do feel like that even for me has broken through the noise. But I go back to any time that there's channel saturation, that channel will become less effective over time. And it's because people are saturating that channel and not saturating other channels, which then means the other channels that you haven't been saturating then become interesting places, right? Like you even think about direct-to-consumer brands starting to use direct physical mail more. You get flyers now for, you know, all of the D2C companies. And 10 years ago, you didn't get any of that mail. But then 20 years ago, you were getting only direct order catalogs, right? Like people stopped using it. People stopped using the channel. And so it became cheaper and less saturated to use that channel. And now more people are using it. And now every single day, I'm like, oh, do I need caraway pans versus blah, blah, blah? Like you get flyers every day for like direct to consumer stuff.
It's like 90% of my mail now is like these flat things that go into the recycling. But like, you know, it must be
cheap and effective. And omnichannel, they're probably hitting you on Instagram and sending a thing to your house.
Yeah. Like, thanks for all this paper. Can you just save a tree instead?
Yeah.
There was so much in here that I wanted to share.
One thing that I wrote down that Erica had said that I thought was so aligned to everything that we talk about was she was saying that with this like bandwagon jumping, that seems to be what marketers have been doing recently. If you jump to like, oh, it's actually, you know, ABM and it's actually dark social and it's actually blah, blah, blah. Like everything that's popular and kind of part of the lexicon is where people jump. She was saying we lost sight of what we do. And the wrong question is like, how do we make more? How do I use this channel or tool or thing? And the right question is, how do I make somebody listen? And I loved it. It was like going back to first principles, going back to what are we all doing here? Going back to like, do executives read blog posts? Like, I think that that's a nice summary of like, when it's always bandwagon hopping and always like, how do I game the system? How do I make more? How do I blah, blah, blah? How do I get somebody to listen? And I love being centered on that idea, especially with her other thing where it's your job to challenge perceptions. It's your job to get somebody to listen.
Yep. I love that too. I'm like, I feel like it was like a very grounding thing to hear. It's like the agitation comes from the lack of originality and approach where it's like, we should be using HubSpot. We should be using AI and or we should be doing organic social or like, what is your objective? What would you like? Right. And it's like, I want revenue. It is my job to figure out how to get people to listen and want to buy in. And it's like, go build the product, go focus on your pricing strategy. Like whatever it is, just like go away.
I was talking to a head of marketing who was at a company and they're currently bringing a product to market, trying to find who will pay for this product, right? They have a product, they've built a product, they're literally shopping it around on the market. And what I've told this person, especially because they're relatively new in their career, like not super new and green, but like haven't worked at too many companies, I said, okay, there are two different types of founders. One founder becomes obsessed with a target audience or target customer base and a problem that they have, and they will build whatever solution it is to solve that problem. And they might be a great technologist, but they're not as in love with their technology or their solution. And they'll just talk to the same customer base with the same problem and iterate until they find something that actually works for them. And that's how you bring them to market, right? Like it's there, it's in the market. I made it for the market. And the other one is this other version that I think we've had so many products come from this other place, which is, I have an idea. I think that there's a market. I'm going to build it. And then if that market doesn't want to buy it, now I got to go find another market to buy this product. And that is a lot of weight to put on marketing. And I think it's kind of for the first time that like marketers have to take ownership over like, do you want this thing? Do you want this thing? Do you want this thing? And every time you do that, then you have to switch who your target audience is, the channels that they like to consume information in, the message that resonates with them, whether or not they are aware or have any sort of affinity for your product. And you have to start from scratch each time that you're like testing it in a market. And so my advice was, the more that you can, as you're looking for new opportunities or opportunities for jobs, is find the founder who's less protective of their solution or their technology and more obsessed with a problem space for a specific audience, because that's a much more fun way to market, because you're not going to get burnt out trying to like recreate a whole marketing program, marketing machine every time that you're trying to ship it or shop it to a new piece of the market.
Yeah. Or if you are the second category where you have a problem you think needs solving and you think you have the product to do that, bring your marketer in at the beginning when you're still developing and do all that testing as you're building. And then it's really fun because you're all on this discovery adventure together. And I think there is a way for that to work, but you need to bring your marketer in at the right time. And that's a similar use case for, I think, another category that's very similar to that second one, which is you are a little bit ahead of an emerging trend, building a media company, you know, companies becoming media companies. That's something that is buzzy right now. But if you ask individuals, they don't really know what it means. And it doesn't mean that it's not of value. Of course, we're becoming a more media-driven consumers. And because of the glories of AI, you can start from media and it can serve your written content, thus making strategies that start there more efficient in a lot of ways. That's another one where, again, like testing is really necessary. And if you're a company that comes in knowing you're starting a movement, I think that is exciting too, where like, I was just talking to Anthony from Audience Plus, and that's what they're doing, right? They're trying to educate while they bring this through the product that they're bringing to market. And they're doing it in multiple different ways, including marketing. And so that's really cool because it's like built into their growth strategy and their business strategy. Then again, going back to what you were saying about, you can tell when marketers are having a good time. I met with their marketing team we were there together. Cause yeah, Ryan Baum was like, they're doing a conference quite literally across the street from my house. And you could tell they were having fun because we were having fun too. Like that conversation didn't feel like a business meeting. It felt like a bunch of friends hanging out. And again, that's where you see this thing working. I tried to like summarize all the takeaways from all these interviews, right? Into like, what is it? And I'm like, okay, playbooks aren't useful anymore, or old playbooks aren't useful anymore. They're the same sort of internal problems as before around communicating value to C-suite and having marketing positioned in a place of power, making fear-based responses around tactics instead of looking at like more deeply at what is working.
And I would say hide fear-based decisions under the guise of needing more data to do something bold. I'm like merging a couple things together where it's definitely fear-based. It's definitely let's pull back. It's definitely let's do what has worked before under the assumption that we don't have enough data to do anything differently. And I wrote this down. Erica was saying like logic versus boldness, or making decisions based on logic and a little bit of boldness, because boldness is differentiation. And this goes back to what I've been saying, which is as software becomes a commodity, commodities compete on brand. Brands compete on differentiation. Like you have to be different in your brand in order to compete. And if your product is the same as 20 other products, the way that you're going to compete is your brand.
Yep. Yes. Boom. Okay, y'all, that's a wrap. Thank you as always for listening.
We'll be back next week. And just remember, you're doing great. You're doing great.
30% of you are doing great. The rest, you got to get your shit together. Come on.
You know which side you're on this week.
You know.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Children, we should listen to, like, forget, like, you know, Taoism, you know, the Tao, where it's like these ones. I think those probably all came from kids.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. Although he also called me a stinky hot dog. So let's not listen to
kids' boy. Oh, little stinky hot dog.
You know, it wasn't nice. It wasn't cute. It wasn't endearing. It was mean. It was in a feat of anger that I was called a stinky hot dog. Yeah. It's a sick burn, honestly. I'm going to keep it in my back pocket for somebody that I get in a fight with.